Have most of the stragglers, so why don't we close the doors and start exactly on time. Now, Stan Evans did not admit when he was so magnanimously chairing that session that he himself is an agent provocateur in the clash between high and low culture. I've seen many virulent examples of this. I'll only tell you about two. But at an ISI session back in the 70s, the audience of undergraduates, 19, 20 years old, and the speaker right before Stan was from Germany, and he did a brilliant speech on the decline of the West, and he had the audience, young audience, but then the first question was, well, Professor, how did this decline get started? And very seriously said to them, it all started with the Beatles. And we lost them. We lost the audience immediately. So Stan fortunately got the next question. And Stan said, well, Professor, I certainly hope that you didn't mean to include Ringo. And we got him back. But at that same trip, I took Stan to a nice French restaurant. I was trying to, you know, ISI's pay scale is such that you have to do some extra things for your lecturers. And took him to a nice French restaurant, and in retaliation, he did everything he could to embarrass me during the entire meal. That's another low-high culture clash. We got in this stuffy restaurant, and very haughty French waiter, and the first thing Stan asked was to have the tablecloth removed. And then, once the tablecloth's removed, he said, now, is this mahogany? I says, why, yes. Says, that's too authentic. I would like formica, please. And it went downhill from there. So then the waiter says to Stan, may I suggest the Coquille Saint-Jacques? And Stan says, well, you can suggest anything you like, but I'll have a burger. And he says, a hamburger? We can accommodate you, monsieur. How would you like it? Stan says, greasy. And then the waiter says, and for dessert? Stan says, do you have Jell-O? The waiter says, why, I believe we could get you some Jell-O, monsieur. Do you have lemon Jell-O, cherry Jell-O? Stan says, I like red. And so don't ever take M. Stanton Evans to a French restaurant. We're turning our attention now from examining the state of our country's culture, both high and low, to that institution which should serve as the preeminent agent for the transmission of culture to the new generation, the university. The higher learning is directed toward what are called humane studies. At root, this means studies appropriate to humankind. And what distinguishes humankind from the rest of God's creation? Well, among other things, through the miracle of language, and specifically the written word, human beings have the capacity to gain knowledge from all that has gone before. Alone of God's creatures, we can learn beyond the confined teachings of our own limited experience. Writ large, this capacity can be called historical consciousness. And historical consciousness, our own Bill McClay wrote once, is to civilize society what memory is to the individual identity. One cannot say who or what one is. One can't say one is anyone at all or anything at all without some selective retention of experience and a source of continuity. One cannot learn, use language, pass on knowledge, raise offspring, or even dwell in society without the aid of memory. A culture without memory will necessarily be barbarous, no matter how technologically advanced and sophisticated, because the daily drumbeat of artificial sensations and amplified events will drown out all other sounds, including the strains of an older music. Well, how is historical consciousness developed and transmitted one generation to the next? Three principal institutions have been entrusted with this most crucial task of society. The family teaches mores, from which it is possible to achieve virtue. The church teaches truth, from which it is possible to achieve understanding. And the schools teach knowledge, from which it is possible to achieve wisdom. It is this last institution that concerns us today. At its basic level, education in this country penetrates universally, for good or ill. Higher education reaches fewer, and fewer still of those become learned enough to engage in serious study and to assist in the transmission of human memory from one generation to the next. It has been traditionally the higher learning that has produced these custodians of the transmission process that Christopher Dawson called enculturation. Since medieval times, and with antecedents that go back to Plato's Academy, enculturation through the higher learning has been primarily the province of the university. The stakes are high. Solzhenitsyn has said that a people which no longer remembers has lost its history and its soul. But there came a time in our own century when the university not only fell down in its high duty toward enculturation, but actually became hostile. The foundation of institutions such as ISI was a response to this very problem, namely the capture of many of our universities by ideologues who rejected the traditional understanding of liberal learning. For the ideologues, the story of the West is the story of unjust systems of oppression, and so nothing affirming can be learned from the study of the past. Whereas the tradition finds leisure as the basis of culture, with the calm contemplation of eternal truths as the promised reward of much study. The ideologues are characterized by movement, by a busyness they call progress. The ideologue is dissatisfied with where we are, with who we are. Now, during the 20th century, the ideologues conducted a long march through cultural institutions, and the university was perhaps their grandest prize. For in their dissatisfaction with man as he is, the ideologues had engaged in the project of creating or cultivating a new man. Karl Marx epitomized this moral worldview when he observed that heretofore, philosophers have sought to understand the world. But the point, he said, is to change the world. And if you want to change the world, if you want to cultivate a new man, where better to begin than with the university? The current iteration of this project is couched in the grand claims of postmodernism, a view which claims to see beyond the constricting lens of modern science, of modern political economy, of modern social science. This is a view which in theory eagerly embraces a thoroughgoing relativism, but in practice is anything but relativistic as it seeks to invert the hierarchy championing the marginal at the expense of things of more central and enduring importance. Thus, English professors have left off reading Milton and instead pore over advertising copy of old magazines. Historians reject the studies of war or high politics and dwell upon kitchen routines or everyday dress in past times. And everywhere, the study of women and minorities become a basis for academic advancement. But like Thrasymachus in Plato's Republic, the postmodernists were trapped by a self-contradiction. They were driven by a heated sense of injustice, but their own moral relativism denied there could be any true standard of justice by which injustice can be admitted. So we can see now that postmodernism was not the world-changing philosophical breakthrough it claimed to be. Rather, postmodernism is simply the last step in the Marxist critique of ideology, a Marxist critique which sought to see through the appearances of bourgeois justice to the so-called realities of power relations behind our institutions. But as C.S. Lewis wrote at the end of that marvelous book on education, The Abolition of Man, you cannot go on explaining away forever. You will find that you have explained explanation itself away. You cannot go on seeing through things forever. The whole point of seeing through something is to see something through it. It is good that the window should be transparent, because the street or the garden beyond is opaque. How if you saw through the garden too? It's no use trying to see through first principles. If you can see through everything, then everything is transparent. But a wholly transparent world is an invisible world. To see through all things is the same as not to see. And so it appears that our academic class has reached this last extremity of utter blindness, But we are fortunate to have with us today three seers who are exceptions that prove the rule. Todd Breivogel has earned his BA in classics from Colorado College. As a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, he earned his second BA in history and a master's degree in theology. He is currently completing his PhD in the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago while teaching in the Honors Program at the University of Denver. Prior to that, he worked for a number of years as a fellow at the Liberty Fund. He is the editor of Ephestrith Literary Imagination, Ancient and Modern Essays in Honor of David Green, and he has published widely, particularly on questions of political theory and especially the thought of St. Augustine. We will be hearing from our three speakers in the order in which they're printed in the program, and let's welcome Todd to the podium.